All right. Air of health, everybody. What I plan to do this evening is the first part of the shiur. We're going to review the special halachas of Purim Mishulash, the three-day Purim in Yerushalayim. We'll try and go through it briefly and explain where at all possible. And then the second half of the shiur is going to be something really a shiur that was said by Rav Soloveitchik some 25, 30 years ago on Megillat Esther, or for that matter on the whole idea of Purim. I may have said parts of it in previous years, but it became so much more relevant to me this year that I want to share it with you again, of real contemporary relevance. So first of all, Purim Mishulash. This year is a special Purim in Yerushalayim. Purim is celebrated over a period of 3 days. In a sense, let's begin with Tainis Esther. I must say one of the things that I have always enjoyed about being in Yerushalayim in particular and in being in Eretz Yisrael in general is coming to Eretz Yisrael. First of all, I found that one day Yom Tov is a very, very good idea. You can get everything into the one Seder. I don't know, Chutz Arts, we told ourselves that, the first Seder, you're, by the second Seder already, everybody's ready for a Seder. In Eretz Yisrael, one day Yontif is okay. The Talmud Yerushalmi in the Sechta Erevin in the third parak says that the 2 days Yontif in Chutz Arts were a punishment for not keeping one day Yontif in Eretz Yisrael. So you come to Eretz Yisrael, I have to take the punishment with me. The punishment was in Chutz Lars, but not in Eretz Yisrael. One day Yontif, I love one day Yontif. And it just occurred to me that people who are going to be here from Chutz Lars for Pesach are going to have another 3 day job. We're going to have Shabbos, Pesach, Erev Pesach is on Shabbos, and Sunday, 2 days. That's not too easy. But they're going to have Monday as well. So, as I say, one of the things that I enjoy about Eretz Yisrael is one day Yontif. And there's something else that I always enjoy. For me, I don't fast terribly well. So, you know what it was like in Chutz Laretz, Tainis Esther, so immediately after the fast, you have to go into the reading of the Megillah. During the course of that reading of the Megillah, I don't know who I began to hate more, Haman or little children. Ich bin hungrig, I'm hungry, I want to get home. And there comes another Haman, and the kids are clapping until you got home after the Megillah, or the Neshama was a Kamat Oizkigang. So therefore I always enjoyed every year Purim in Yerushalayim, in Yerushalayim in particular. After the fast is over, you go home and you eat, and it's one of those days that's neither here nor there. And the following day at night, when everybody else is winding down or wiped out, we come to the reading of the Megillah. Unfortunately, we're going to get the feeling of what it is to listen to the Megillah while hungry and fasting, and I'm going to try and control myself, and all of my anger is going to go out against Haman and not the Tayre Yiddish Kinderlach that are going to clap Haman. So that's number one. Tomorrow we join all of Klal Yisrael, the fast of Esther, and following Tainis Esther is going to be the reading of the Megillah. Now, by right, of course, all of the mitzvahs of Purim should be on the 15th day of the month of Adar. But the 15th of Adar occurs on Shabbos. So when it occurs on Shabbos, obviously you can't read the Megillah, because our rabbis who said you don't blow shofar on Rosh Hashanah that occurs on Shabbos, and said that you don't take lulav and esrog on Sukkos that occurs on Shabbos, also said in the same takana, they said that you don't read the Megillah when Purim occurs on Shabbos. That for us, that can only mean Purim in Yerushalayim. because according to the way our calendar is set up, the 14th day of Adar never falls on a Shabbos. It's only the 15th, and that's what we have this year, the 15th, so you can't read the Megillah on Shabbos, because our rabbis were concerned that in the fervor or desire to fulfill the mitzvah, be it hearing the shofar, taking lulav and esrog, or the reading of the Megillah, one may end up carrying the Megillah, the shofar, or lulav and esrog out in the street in a place where there's no erev, and there will be chil Shabbos as a result. So therefore, Abba Chachamim said, "Shev, sit, v'al tase, don't fulfill the mitzvah." So then, we can't read the Megillah on Shabbos. If you can't read the Megillah on Shabbos, then you have one of two choices. You can read the Megillah before Shabbos, or you can read the Megillah after Shabbos. Which choice should we take? Says the Gemara that the reading of the Megillah, Magdimin, you are supposed to have it before Tetvav, before the 15th day of Adar. And the Gemara says, because we learn it from a pasuk that says, "Kimu v'kiblu ha'yehudim aleihem v'al zaram v'al kol anilv aleihem," Jews accepted upon themselves, v'lo ya'avor, without fail, or also v'lo ya'avor means not to pass beyond that day, l'hiyot osim et shnei hayamim ha'ele kichsavim v'chizmanim, to make these 2 days as it was written, and in their time, v'chol shonah v'shonah. So from the words v'lo ya'avor, it shall not pass over, it means you can't go beyond the 15th. If you can't go beyond the 15th, and you can't read the Megillah on the 15th, so therefore there's no choice. The only choice is to read the Megillah on the 14th. So we read the Megillah together with everybody else in the world, Thursday night and Friday morning. One of the mitzvahs of Purim is inextricably intertwined with the reading of the Megillah. It's tzamud. Tzamud. Anybody have a good word for tzamud? Huh? Inextricably intertwined. That's what you want, huh? Linked. Linked. Very good. Linked. The mitzvah of matanas levyonim, gifts to the poor, is linked to the mitzvah of the reading of the Megillah. Because the Gemara Masechta Megillah says, "Einehem shel aniyim nesuot lemikra Megillah." The eyes of the poor look forward to the reading of the Megillah, because that's the time at which people would give money to the poor. So therefore, the mitzvah of Matanas Lavyonim also is to take place on Friday. So there are two mitzvahs on Friday. We are going to see that there are going to be two mitzvahs of Purim that are going to be fulfilled each one of the 3 days. So the two mitzvahs of Purim that are going to be fulfilled on Friday. So the two mitzvahs that we fulfill on Friday, the mitzvah of the reading of the Megillah and the mitzvah of Matanos Levyonim. And as I began to say, there are going to be two mitzvahs each day. Of course, one of the many strange things about Friday is that while we will read the Megillah and we're going to give Matanas Lavyonim, we don't say Al Hanisim. Al Hanisim isn't said Thursday night, it isn't said on Friday, because it's not really Purim. When does Purim indeed begin for us? It begins with Friday night. So during the course of the entire Shabbos, you say Al Hanisim in davening and in benching. What else do we do on Shabbos in addition to the mitzvah of saying Al Hanisim? The reading of the Torah, the Kriyas HaTorah for Purim, is said on Shabbos. The rest of the world, they're going to be reading the Torah Friday morning. Our davening Friday morning is going to be a regular Friday morning davening, with only the addition of the reading of the Megillah. There will not be a Torah reading. That Torah reading is going to take place on Shabbos. What Torah reading is it on Shabbos? The Torah reading is the reading from the end of Parshat Bishalach, where we have the story of the sneak attack of Amalek. Vayovo Amalek came, vayilachem in Yisrael b'Refidim, and he waged war with Yisrael in Refidim. So we read that. That means we take our two Sifrei Torah. In the first Sefer Torah, we're going to read Parshat Kitisa. In the second Sefer Torah, we're going to read from the end of Parshat Bishalach, which is the mafta that describes the story of the Amalek attack. And then, fascinatingly enough, the only time it ever happens, the Haftorah that we're going to read on Shabbos is precisely the same Haftorah that we read last week. The only time in history when you have the same Haftorah read 2 weeks in a row. The Haftorah for last week, which was Parshas Zachar, was the Haftorah that describes in Sefer Shmuel Shaul's battle against Amalek. Precisely the same Haftorah is going to be read on this Shabbos in Yerushalayim. So the two mitzvahs of Shabbos are going to be the mitzvah of saying Al Hanisim and the mitzvah of Kriyas HaTorah VaHaftorah. Somebody in Shul pointed out to me something that I had never been aware of. In Yerushalayim this year, there's something else that is fascinating. There are going to be 5 weeks in a row in which more than one Sefer Torah is used on Shabbos. We started back with Rosh Chodesh Adar occurred on Shabbos. The second day Rosh Chodesh Adar was on Shabbos, so we took out then 3 Sefer Torah. In one Sefer Torah we read Parshat HaShavua, and the second we read the Parsha of Rosh Chodesh, and the third one Parshat Shkolim. The following Shabbos was last Shabbos, which we took out 2 Sefer Torah. One was Parshat HaShavua, and the second was Parshat Zachar. In Yerushalayim, we're going to take out 2 Sefer Torah this Shabbos. One is going to be the Parshat HaShavua, and the second is going to be Vayavo Amalek Amalekei. And then the next 2 Shabbatot are going to be Parshat Parah and Parshat HaChodesh. Each one, we're going to take out 2 Sefer Torah, one in which we read the Parshat HaShavua, and the other in which we read that which should be read for Parshat HaChodesh, for Parshat Parah and for Parshat HaChodesh. Okay. So that takes care of Shabbos. So we have 2 mitzvahs that are left. And those 2 mitzvahs are the mitzvahs that we're going to fulfill on Sunday. Mitzvahs of Sunday are going to be the mitzvah of Seudas Purim, the feast of Purim, and the mitzvah of Mishloach Manot, sending gifts, because just as Matanos Levyonim, the gifts to the poor, is linked to the reading of the Megillah, Mishloach Manot is linked to the Suda, to make certain that that other people have a Suda. So therefore you should send at least to one person 2 or more items of food, manot, portions. That's what Mishloach, the sending of portions. So those are going to be the 2 mitzvahs of Sunday, which of course means that nothing else is going to be done on Sunday. You don't say Al Hanisim. Maybe the only other thing that of course you should do is the mitzvah of Chayiv Odom Lipsumei Bepuria, that a person should get a little high on Purim, drink a little bit. That mitzvah should be fulfilled on Sunday. I imagine there are certainly people who are machmer to Friday and Shabbos and Sunday and Monday, etc. Now, a question that you should have asked me, and I think I saw it on everybody's face, you were all extremely upset about this, and you wanted to ask the question, number one, why can't we have the Seudas Purim on Shabbos? And number two, if you're not permitted to go beyond the 15th, and therefore you have to read the Megillah on Friday, how do we have the Seudas Purim and Mishloach Manos on the 16th, which is the day after the 15th? According to the Pasuk, it should all be over. So there are a number of answers that I give it. Number one, why not on Shabbos? Why can't you have the Seuda on Shabbos? A number of reasons. One is a Talmud Yerushalmi on this same pasuk that we had mentioned, Lihyot Osim, to make, Lihyot Osim et Shnei Hayomim Eilu, to make these 2 days days of Yontif. Says the Talmud Yerushalmi, the Yontif has to be celebrated on a day that we make, which excludes Shabbos. Shabbos is not made by us. Shabbos is made by God. Shabbos is a day since the first Shabbos. It is a chok kavua. It's part of nature. It's built in. What days do we make? We make the days of the month. Because to whom did HaKadosh Baruch Hu give the power to establish a calendar? That was to us. It has to be days on which we make. Of course, there are others who say that the Seuda of Purim has to be recognizable that it's a Seudas Purim, and on Shabbos it wouldn't be recognizable that it's a Seudas. And then there are those who say Ein Ma'arvin Simcha B'Simcha. You can't have two smachot together, a Shabbos meal and a Yontif meal. So we've answered why not on Shabbos. The question is, How do we do it the day after the 15th? It's now the 16th. So many say that the prohibition of the Lo Yavor is with regard to Zechira. You can't pass the 15th day with regard to the mitzvah of Zechira, remembering. And that's the mitzvah of the reading of the Megillah. It's only the reading of the Megillah that cannot be beyond the 15th. But the Suda and the Shmarach Manos can be beyond the 15th. There are also those who say that the Mishloach Manos and the Sudas Purim really should have been on Shabbos, but we don't do it on Shabbos so that it should be recognizable that it is a Sudas Purim. So therefore the Sunday, in a sense, if we're linking already, there's another linkage. The Sunday, in a sense, becomes the day that is linked to the Shabbos. And in a sense, we make up on Sunday what we should have done on Shabbos. Right now, as I'm thinking, I don't know if it's a good idea, but I don't know, it just occurs to me, there are other things. There's a halach in Shulchan Aruch, if somebody had a bad dream, and he Friday night and he wants to fast on Shabbos, he feels he's upset. So the halach is, since that's his own egg Shabbos, to fast, he wants to do tshuva, so he's supposed to fast, he may fast on Shabbos. But then he has to fast another day to make up for having fasted on Shabbos, and preferably it should be done on Sunday. So in a sense, the Sunday is linked to the Shabbos. That's what happens with this Sunday here. Sunday is linked to the Shabbos. There are, of course, fascinating question that I asked in Shul. Is it possible for somebody to be obligated in the mitzvah of the Suda and Mishloach Manos and not obligated in the mitzvah of reading the Megillah or Matanos Lavyonim? Is there any such thing? Can there be a split personality? Chayev in two of the mitzvahs and potter from another two of the mitzvahs. Of course it's possible. What about a boy who's bar mitzvah this Shabbos? If he was born on the 15th, and his bar mitzvah is going to be on the 15th. We happen to have a boy who's getting bar mitzvah this Shabbos, who was born 13 years ago the last time there was a 3-day Purim, and he was born on Shabbos. So now, when he's going to get bar mitzvah on Shabbos, on Friday he wasn't bar mitzvah yet, so he wasn't obligated in the mitzvah of the reading of the Megillah. By Sunday he's bar mitzvah, so he's obligated in the mitzvah of the Sudas Purim and the Shloach Manot. And before I left the house, somebody called me to invite me to a bar mitzvah, Mitzvah Shabbos. The Binyan Rebbe's son, is a grandson of a close friend of mine, big Rebbe Shabbat Mitzvah, Mitzvah Shabbos. And the boy's target, his bar mitzvah is on the 16th, Mitzvah Shabbos on Sunday. So he's not even chayiv in the mitzvah of Sudas Purim. Even though Sudas Purim is going to be on Sunday, but since the Sudas Purim on Sunday is only to make up for what we didn't do on Shabbos he wasn't bar mitzvah yet. Shabbos he wasn't bar mitzvah, he wasn't obligated in any of the mitzvahs. So therefore, he doesn't really have to eat the Sudas Purim unless he's hungry and wants to eat with the family. There are people who are machmer on a number of things. There are some who say, you should have the Sudas Purim on Shabbos. So if you wish, if you add something to the Sudas Shabbos, I don't know, an extra piece of a Purim kugel, so that can already turn the Sudas Shabbos into, if you want to be certain that you fulfill the Suda, for that matter, you can have in mind on Friday when you eat, you can have in mind the Sudas Purim. You want to send Mishloach Manos, you can do all of that. But the obligation is spread out over the 3 days, and that's why it's called Purim Mishulash. Of course, some of the questions that I got during the course of the week were fascinating. Somebody calls me, they're going on a Mitzvah Shabbos flight to America. It can be Yerushalayim Shabbos and Yerushalayim Matzah Shabbos. They're going to the airport. So what are you supposed to do? I get the question. What are you supposed to do? It's simple, what you're supposed to do. You can have the great experience of eating the Purim Suda in Flatbush. Because the halacha is that anybody who was Shabbos in Yerushalayim has a responsibility on Sunday to eat the Sudas Purim and give Shalach Manos wherever one may be in the world.
if they did it already?
What do you mean, even if they did it already?
What if somebody was Mekayim Mitzvah on Friday?
No. We'll get to that. One moment. We'll get to that. It means somebody who is obligated in the Yerushalayim Purim and leaves Yerushalayim. Doesn't have to be as exciting as going to the States. Somebody goes to Tel Aviv on Sunday or any place else. They have a responsibility, an obligation to fulfill the mitzvah of Sudas Purim wherever one may be. It could be, there's another part that may be slightly problematic, and that is, there's a question, if you're giving Shalach Manis on Sunday, do you necessarily have to give to a Yerushalmi? Because on Sunday it's not Purim for anybody else in the world. Chances are that according to most Shittas, you would have to give Shalach Manis in the first instance to somebody from Yerushalayim who also has to have a Suda. You understand? But even because he doesn't have to accept it. So let's say that, let's figure out that sentence again. The only one's non-acceptance that is acceptable is the one whose acceptance would have been acceptable. Well, we're not going to talk about Ramot. They have their own rabbis over there. Let them figure out what to do in Ramot. Now, so therefore, what I did suggest to the person who asked me the Shaila is, first of all, check on the plane. Chances are that there's another Yerushalmi on the plane. Chances are that there's another Yerushalmi. When do I find out who from Har Nof is going on the same flight that I'm going? When Nesha comes at 4 o'clock in the morning, you understand, and everybody on the block is in the Nesha. I mean, it's amazing. You find out early in the morning that your next door neighbor is going to America and your friend down the block is going. So your chances are, not only will you find a Yerushalmi on the plane, you're going to find somebody from Har Nof, and it may even be somebody you like, and you'd want to give him Shalach Manis. So therefore, I said, breakfast, just exchange meals and you on the plane, and you have fulfilled the mitzvah of Shalach Manis. But it has to be done after a day begins, because all of the mitzvahs of Purim have to be fulfilled during the day, except for the reading of the Megillah the first night. So that means a moment that it's dawn, and in the back of the plane already they're beginning to put on towels and tefillin, and that there's always somebody that's going to wake me up and schlep me for a minyan. All right, like it's a good thing to talk with a minyan. So for breakfast already, you exchange meals and you fulfill the mitzvah. Of course, there's also the other problem that becomes a bit confusing, and it's always confusing, maybe a little bit more this year than other years, and that is somebody who travels from one place to the next. Somebody is in Tel Aviv. So if somebody is in Tel Aviv Thursday, not Tel Aviv, Beit El, Shiloh, that's better. If somebody is... Yeah, and then they come for Shabbos to Yerushalayim. The truth is that they have to keep a second day, even though there are some opinions that say that somebody told it to me in the name of Rav Shlomo Zalman. I didn't see it. He says that the determining moment is, or the period that determines one's halacha is where he is this Thursday night. And therefore, if Thursday night one is outside of Yerushalayim, their only responsibility is Thursday night and Friday. There are other opinions who say that outside of Yerushalayim, it's Thursday night that determines one's obligation. And in Yerushalayim, Friday night determines one's obligation. So that one may very well be obligated in keeping 2 days or 3 days for it. I think that covers just about nearly all of the eventualities. Somebody faxed me a shaila this morning, and I thought it was a silly question. Do you say Tachnun on Sunday in Yerushalayim? I mean, everything that I had seen said, of course you don't say Tachnun. But then I found that it seems a few hundred years ago some people said Tachnun in Yerushalayim on Sunday, because it's really after Purim. So like it's Nishtahin and Nishtaher. and everybody got upset with them, and then the minute was established that Yerushalayim Sunday is completely Yontif all of the way. Unfortunately, I also had a number of Shilas this week, out of Tulafayas this week. Tulafayas. So, what's the halacha? The halacha is that there is no avelos b'fahesya on Purim. Public avelos on Purim. No such thing. Which means, therefore, that tomorrow night, anybody who is in the middle of Shiva changes clothing, puts on shoes, and goes to shul. Goes to shul not only Thursday night, but goes Friday, has to fulfill all of the mitzvahs of Purim if they are outside of Yerushalayim. If they are in Yerushalayim, same thing. The only thing that may be interesting, and it seems to me from my investigation, is Saturday night, Maitzoy Shabbos, is really, there's no yontif to Maitzoy Shabbos. There's no mitzvah to be fulfilled Maitzoy Shabbos. Nothing. The only mitzvahs of Sunday are going to be during the day, which is Sudas Purim and Mishloach Manos. So they would have to sit Shiva Maitzoy Shabbos, so it would seem from my investigation. But then on Sunday again, there is no Shiva. That's part one of the shir. I think we've taken care of that, and Yirtzeh Hashem, we hope that this 3-day Purim in Yerushalayim is going to be the beginning of great joy for Klal Yisrael. All right, Rav Soloveitchik. A shir, I don't remember, 1974. 74, how many years ago was that? That's 20 years ago. Shir that he said 20 years ago. 20 years ago. Listen, in a month from now will be the Pesach is the first Yahrzeit. Very, very powerful message. So I hope I will do the Rav a little bit of justice. The Gemara in Masechta Megillah says the following. The Gemara is talking about the mitzvah of reading the Megillah at night and then repeating the reading of the Megillah during the day. And there are two opinions in the Gemara. One opinion in the Gemara says the following. Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi said, Chayev Odom Likrotat HaMegillah, a person is obligated to read the Megillah at night and to repeat it, L'shanota B'yom, to repeat it again during the day. Shen Ne'emar, how do we know that you have to read the Megillah both night and day? Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi brings a pasuk from Tehillim, Chapter 22 of Tehillim, where it says the following, Elokai ekra yomam, God, I call to you during the day, velo tane, and you don't answer. Velaila, and I call at night, velo dumiali, and there is no comfort for me. Which seems that one cries out to God at night and during the day. That chapter in Tehillim, chapter 22, according to the Gemara, that was the chapter in Tehillim that was said by Esther as she prepared to enter the throne room of Ahasuerus. And a moment from now, in another moment, she may be cut down and killed because anybody who comes to the king, unannounced and uninvited, achad datol hamit, the halacha is that the law is one will be put to death except for the one whom the king is going to extend his golden scepter. So she's standing now in the outer room, ready to walk into the throne room. She doesn't know what the next moment is going to hold for her. So she says that kapitel, it's Lanatzeach ala Yelet Hashacha. Lanatzeach ala Yelet Hashacha. Dawn. Esther was the dawn of a new day. It begins, Keili, Keili, Lama Azavtani. My God, why did you forsake me? So in that chapter it says, I call unto God during the day and he doesn't answer, and I call out at night and there's no comfort. There's a second opinion in the Gemara. Rabbi Chelbo, in the name of Ula Biro, says that you have to read the Megillah at night and then repeat it again during the day, because it says in a perek in Tehillim that we say every day in davening, Mizmor Shir Chanukat HaBayit LeDavid, the song that David wrote for the Chanukah Tabayit, the dedication of the Beit HaMikdash. And there it says, Leman Yizamer Chochavod, in order that we should sing of God's glory, V'lo Yidom, and not to remain silent. Hashem Elokai, God my God, La'olam Odek, I will always thank you. in that same chapter, it's talking about day and night, because it says, "Bo'erev yomim bechi," at night I went to sleep crying. "V'la'boger," but in the morning, "rina," there was great song. And in this pasuk, it's talking about singing and not remaining silent. Always thanking God. It represents, therefore, day and night. The problem, of course, is in these two opinions in the Gemara, the two opinions in the Gemara are day and night. The chapter of Esther, the chapter 22 in Tehillim, is talking about a human being who is frightened, terrified, cries out in pain and agony to God, and doesn't know whether God is going to listen. The mood of chapter 22 is a person who is in dire straits, trembling, terrified, not knowing what the next moment is going to bring. And then when you take the second opinion of the Gemara, what's the mood of Mizmor Shir Chanukat HaBayit L'David? Do you know what that mood is? It's a mood of joy, happiness, jubilation, singing, L'mayin Zamercho Kavod, to sing to God. There are the two opinions in the Gemara that are telling us precisely the same halacha, that you're supposed to read the Megillah at night and then read it again during the day, are describing two completely contradictory moods. One is a mood of fear, and the other is a mood of joy. One is terror, and the other is thanksgiving. How do these two relate to Purim? Except, of course, both of these characterizations of the Megillah, they're both correct. Because in the Purim story, the first part of the story is fear, terror, trepidation, fear of the unknown. Klal Yisrael is under threat of total destruction. Men, women, and children on one day. The second half of the Megillah, all of a sudden, v'napalcho, there's a dramatic change. And fear passes, and what takes its place? Great joy and happiness. That's the second part of the Megillah. That means in the celebration or mocking of Purim, both of these moods have to be expressed. How indeed are they expressed? The first mood is the mood of Tainis Esther. The fast of Esther represents part one of Purim. The fear, the terror, the agony, the pain, that's Tainis Esther. Purim becomes the second part, the day of joy, the day of thanksgiving, the day of song, the day of Chayiv Adam Lepsumi Bapuria, complete and total abandon. The Chachmei HaKabbalah say, that the holiest day of the year, Yom HaKippurim, if you want to know the inner significance of Yom HaKippurim, it is a day, Kippurim. You understand? You hear what the Chachmei HaKabbalah is saying? If you want to know that holiest day of the year, the day that begins with the electricity in a shul of Kol Nidre, you can cut the sanctity with a knife. That holiest of holy days, you want to know its meaning? It's Kippurim, like Purim. What's that supposed to mean? What is that supposed to mean? In other words, you're telling me that the holiest, somberest day of the year, if you want to know what its significance is, like the most frivolous day of the year. But that's what they say, so we're going to have to understand what it means. Certainly in one part, in the first part of Purim, we can see the idea of Yom Kippur. The first part of Purim, the first mood, is the mood indeed of fear, terror, trepidation. One's life is hanging in the balance. The lives of all of Klal Yisrael were hanging in the balance. We can see that in the Tainis Esther part of Purim. But we're going to get back to this analogy, Yom HaKippurim. These two moods, the two moods that are expressed by the two opinions in the Gemara, are indeed and in fact the existential human condition. That's really what life is all about. Man is a frightened being. when he really thinks about life seriously, life can be a very, very scary thing. It's certainly a great deal better than the alternative, but it can be very, very scary. And it is particularly frightening for man. The animal does not have a memory, nor does the animal have any anticipation of the future. The animal always lives only in one time frame, in the time frame of the present. Man lives in three dimensions. He knows of the past, he has anticipations or fears of the future. Man knows when he thinks about it that anything can happen in the next hour, in the next day. Who knows? Does anybody have any guarantees? Nobody has any guarantees. Nobody has any guarantees, therefore means that the thinking human being is a frightened being. And if it was said that ignorance is bliss, it's because we are, thank God, able to put a lot of these fears into the back of our minds so that we are able to function. If we would be aware of all the things that can go wrong, we would be terrified individuals. We could not function. We'd be paralyzed. And then again, of course, you know that all the things that we worry about, they're the ones that don't happen. It's the something else that we didn't worry about. That's the one that's going to happen. Don't try to figure out what that one is so that you can worry about that too. Man, thinking man, lives with the fear of pachad pitom, that which can happen suddenly. That happens all the time. Thank God most of the time it's happening to somebody else, but we know that whatever happens to somebody else can happen to us. There are no guarantees. In a word, what we are talking about is the vulnerability of man. Man is a vulnerable being. Anything can happen to him. The vulnerability of man can also be beneficial. It's precisely this vulnerability of man that makes it possible for him to pray. The person who's healthy prays Refa'enu because he knows what could be, and therefore, though he is well, he prays for health. The person who is wealthy prays for wealth. Does anybody have any guarantee that they're going to have their wealth? Nobody has any guarantees. Nobody has any guarantees. Anybody who had money in the stock market here a week ago was poor at the beginning of the week, and he's rich at the end of the week. McKen, then this is what's going to happen with the stock market, up, down. How many people in the world lost their fortunes because they had money in real estate? Größe, Gewirren, Adirin, great, and wealthy people are not wealthy anymore. Anything can happen, and one never knows. One never knows when it's going to happen. In a sense, man also very often feels as though he is a victim of circumstances beyond his control. And that's more frightening than anything else. We always want to have this feeling as though we're in control. The moment we lose control of events, or the moment that we feel we can't control, we don't have input into an event, we feel as though things are happening to us and we can't do anything about it. That's the very essence of the Purim experience. The fear of the sudden unknown. The whole story of the Megillah is the story of sudden and dramatic changes. A queen with blue blood coursing through her veins enjoys 187 days of partying and frolicking in Shushan. Did it occur to her for a moment on the 187th day that by the end of that day she would be executed? It occurred to her. What are you talking about? You would have told her that at the beginning of the day. She would have looked at you like you're mad, stock-raising mad. Bixon Vaseresh. They were planning the assassination of Ahasuerus. Do you know what goes into the planning of an assassination? They already had people. They had already decided who was going to be the Rosh Memshala and who was going to be the Sarachutz. They most probably had all sorts of people waiting throughout the realm to rise at the moment that Ahasuerus is assassinated. All of these great plans come to naught, and the day on which Bigson Vaseres thought that they were going to achieve power over 127 states, the whole world, they find themselves hanging at the end of a rope. Haman comes to a party the second day, twice. He's invited, the only one who's invited to a party with Esther. You think it occurs to him that he's going to be hanging that day from precisely the gallows he had made in order to hang Mordecai? And then there's a little girl, a girl in Shushan, an unknown, becomes the queen. The whole story of the Megillah is the story of dramatic and sudden change, the kinds of things that shake up the human being. The whole story of the Megillah, two words, the Napohu. Everything is topsy-turvy. Life is topsy-turvy. And it can happen at the most unexpected moments of all. The Rav says, therefore, that the Megillah is the story, the book of vulnerability, which characterizes human life generally, and it characterizes the Megillah more than anything else. And particularly, vulnerability, we will see, is that which governs the destiny of the Jew. If all people are vulnerable, Jews are infinitely more vulnerable. There's another advantage to vulnerability. The advantage to vulnerability, or the one who's aware of his own vulnerability, is it gives birth to humility. Humility. Which one of us has not met up with the person who is in power, and the power breeds an arrogance. Wealth breeds arrogance. And doesn't occur to this arrogant person that, you know, tomorrow you may be out of office, tomorrow you're going to be poor, you're going to need our tithes. Don't we see the dramatic changes that take place in governments and people? Just, I don't know why it doesn't happen over here. 45 years, the same people are running the country. It's time for a change. It's time for a change. Is that? But listen, Bush out of office, Vardika Mesek, Carter, what, out of office, do I know what's going to be with Clinton? Do I know what's going to be with Assad? Mubarak is, you understand, the Israeli intelligence says that Mubarak is in serious trouble. The Ramatkal, the army says he's in serious trouble. Only one person says Mubarak is solid. The great optimist Peres disagrees with them all. I read that in the paper yesterday. This guy, everything's going well. It's great. I imagine he's going for vacation to Sarajevo. It must be terrific over there. All right. Vulnerability leads to humility. Leads to humility. Chapter 17. By the way, I do want to point out that everything that we are saying in chapter 17 is really setting the stage for an understanding of everything that's going to go further. The shiur that we had about clothing, were you at the clothing shiur? What's the clothing?
She wasn't here, so I gave my notes.
You gave her. That clearly is going to explain many things that we're going to come across in Sefer Shmuel. So that we're not dealing merely with chapter 17. Chapter 17 lays the foundations for many things to come later. No,
you do.
There is absolutely no way at all. But Sarah, I will tell you the following. If you call me during the week, I'll make a tape for you. I'm not going to bring you the tape. The tape nobody gets. Of all the character traits, of all character traits, the Rambam always says, you should find the golden mean, neither one of the extremes, only one character trait does the Rambam say, you have to go to the extreme. And that's from the Mishnah in Avos, Ma'od Ma'od Heveshval Ruach. One should be humble and lowly. Nobody has the right, because he has money, or he has health, or he has power, prominence, position. Never does he have the right to act with any kind of arrogance toward any fellow human being. Doesn't have a clue when everything can change dramatically, and it's happening all the time. And I'm sure that each and every one of us, in our own experience, and if I start telling you my experiences, boy, we'd never get out of here. And I'm just afraid that people will recognize themselves on the tapes. So I'm not going to. We've all had run-ins with people who, while they are in power or wealthy, they feel they can push everybody around. And then comes the day, and it's a terrible thing. Arrogance is the worst. No human being ever has the right to act with any kind of arrogance to any other fellow human being. You never know what's going to happen to you. The humility that comes as a result of vulnerability, knowing one's own humanity and the frailness and the fickleness of a human being, is one of the ingredients in the mess of Purim. Mordechai makes no big deal about his being a member of the inner cabinet. He commands Esther not to divulge that she is from a royal family. What would have been more natural than to say that, Esther has royalty coursing through her veins? Mordechai says, "Shut, say nothing." I wouldn't be a bit surprised if Ahasuerus would have known that she's from a royal family, he would never have married her. He already had his fill with a woman from a royal family. He didn't want another one from a royal family. On the contrary, it's only because she's an unknown and he assumes that she's a commoner that he's interested in her. He needed the arrogance of a Vashti who's not going to listen to him. The humility of a Mordechai, shashtil, silently, he's there. He's moving around the palace, but he doesn't push his weight around at any moment. Vulnerability is a universal condition. All human beings are vulnerable. But as we say, vulnerability characterizes the condition of the Jew. And I have a feeling, I'm really learning Torah, but anyone who takes chances with the security of the state of Israel is unaware, doesn't know the message of vulnerability. It makes me a little bit sick every time I see a statement that we don't have anything to worry. We have to worry? We have a mighty army. We'll crush them if they try anything. Very bad. Very bad. That's not the way we're supposed to approach whatever process is taking place. Like, Saul is strong enough. I don't understand. For some strange reason, they haven't been able to finish off the Intifada in 6 years. A bigger Intifada that they will be able to take care of. Anyway, what is it more than anything else that characterizes vulnerability? And of all things, there's a pasuk here in the Megillah that says, "Al kein korul ayonim ha'ele Purim." Therefore, they called these days Purim al shem ha'pur, because Haman drew lots. I'm sure that if we put together a committee over here to figure out a name for Purim, we could come up with what we would think was a better name. The name of the yontif should be because that Rosh Haman cast lots. That's why it's called Purim. I'm sure we could call it, I don't know, the Chag HaGeula, the Yom HaYeshua, I don't know, Esther and Mordechai. I'm sure we can find a great name. But it's called Purim Al Shem HaPur because of the lots that were drawn. Says the Rav brilliantly. Brilliant. What's the central service in the Beis HaMikdash on Yom Kippur? The central part of the service, two goats are brought before the Kohen Gadol. The halacha says that the two goats have to be equal in size, in appearance, in value, and purchased at the same time. For all intents and purposes, two similar goats stand in front of the Kohen Gadol. He's going to put his hand into a box and he's going to draw lots. One of those lots is going to decide the fate of one and then the other goat. One is going to be brought before God in the Beis HaMikdash on the holiest of days, and the other one is going to be taken out someplace in the desert and thrown down a cliff. Lots. Do you know what lots represent? The drawing of lots represent what seems to be the chance, the wheel of fortune, fate. Anything can happen at any moment. That's what Purim was all about. That's why Yom HaKippurim is a day like Purim, because Purim is the story of vulnerability. Purim is the story of sudden and dramatic change. Purim seems to be the story of it's fate. Lots are drawn, and the decision is made. And that's what happens on Yom Kippur. But that's only superficially. What's really the celebration of Purim? That what seems to be random, what seems to be fate, there is a hand, a divine hand behind it all. The Jew never has the right to feel as though he is the victim of blind fate out there, and God forbid, it's a world without meaning, without substance, without guidance, without direction. That's the whole point of Megillat Esther. Megillat Esther is that we reveal that which is concealed. If you look at things superficially, it may very well seem as though everything is chance, and I'm no more than a victim of all sorts of forces out there over which I have absolutely no control. Says the Megillah, na-na-na-na. HaKadosh Baruch Hu's name doesn't appear in the Megillah, but if you look carefully, you're going to see him. He is the one who is the mover of all events. So that the message of Purim to vulnerable man is that we're not that vulnerable. We have somebody upon whom we can depend. Ein lanu al mi lishoy, the one whom we can depend on is Avinu Shebashamayim. The Rav concluded this year with listing four lessons of the Purim experience. I may not do justice to them, but I'm going to give you the four lessons of the Purim experience, which are absolutely contemporary and relevant. And that was really part of the pasuk that we learned, Hayom Ha'ela, these days shall never pass away, their memory shall not be forgotten. The message of Purim is something that we have to remember in each and every generation. Lesson one. Lesson one is, we are people, we have faith in man. Our faith in man should never blind us to the potential demonic in man. Man can turn into Satan. Man can become a beast. Man can become a killer. We dare never lose sight of that. We can't place our faith or our trust in any human being. That's why it says in the Megillah at the end of chapter 3, V'hados nitna b'shushan habira, the law, harotzim yotzu dechufim, the riders ran out hurriedly and hastily with B'dvar HaMelech carrying the word of the king, V'hados nitna b'shushan habira, and the law was promulgated in Shushan habira, V'hamelech v'haman yashu lishtos, the king and Haman sat down to drink, V'ha'ir Shushan navocha, and the city of Shushan, the word is Navocha. Navocha means confused. Why doesn't it say sad? Why doesn't it say frightened? Why doesn't it say terrified? Because the first reaction was confusion. What are you talking about? Haman wants to destroy all the Jews. What are you talking about? Just 2 days ago, he was the speaker at a dinner for the local yeshiva, the yeshiva of Shushan. What nice things he said. He's going to kill all the Jews. What are you talking about? You should have heard the things that he said. He said at the conference of presidents of the major Jewish organizations in Shushan. What are you talking about? Haman. I've met with Haman. I dined with Haman. Haman has been in my... He wants to destroy all of the Jews. Can't be. Jews? We're the ones who've contributed more than any other minority group to the economy of Persia, to the arts, to the sciences, to technology. What we've done for the banks and for insurance and for the stock market. Can't be. Terrible mistake. A Jew always has to be aware that there is a potential in man to turn into Satan. Certainly, let me add, one who is already Satan can certainly remain Satan. You have to have a lot of faith to think that the demon turned into a human being. Right, that's stretching things a little bit too far. God says, fine human being. What was Hitler Germany? They weren't the people of Goethe and Faust and Wagner and Schiller and we're talking about art and literature and all of the rest. They turned into Chayes Rors, the worst beast the world ever saw. Lesson number one is man can turn into beast. And that's why there's Milchama LaHashem Ta'amolek Midor Dor. The battle against Amalek goes on for all generations. The Rav, on a number of occasions, quoted his father Chav Moshe, and just in Shul this Shabbos, somebody told me the same thing was said by Rav Kook, that the definition of Amalek, see, because there's a problem, let me explain the problem. The Rambam says that there was a mitzvah to destroy the Kenani, the Chiti, the Aprizi, the Yavusi, the Amori, and then the Rambam says that the mitzvah no longer applies because we have lost them. These people became assimilated within mankind throughout the world. There's no way for us to know who's a Kenani, or a Prizi, or a Chivi, or a Chiti, a Yevusi, a Girgashi. So, Ukvar Ovat Zichrom, their memory is forgotten. Sancheret came and he mixed up all of the nations. There was assimilation, there was intermarriage, lost. The next halacha the Rambam says, it's a mitzvah to destroy Amalek. Asked Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, why doesn't the Rambam here also say, just like he said by Knani and Prizi and Amori and all of the rest, we don't know who they are anymore. He should have said here also, but the mitzvah of destroying Amalek no longer applies because we don't know who's an Amaleki, who's a real, real genuine Amaleki. Says Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, from this Rambam we learn that Amalek is not biological. Amalek is not a biological entity, it's an illogical entity. It's an irrational entity. Who is Amalek? Anybody whose program is the destruction of the Jewish people has the din of Amalek. Anybody whose covenant, for example, if there be such a thing, anybody whose covenant calls for the destruction of the state of Israel has the halacha of Amalek. That's lesson number one. Lesson number two is that when man, Satan, emerges upon the scene of history, man, Satan, is a threat to all of mankind in general. But he's always going to be the greatest threat to the Jewish people. Hitler wanted to world domination, but his main task was the destruction of the Jewish people. Stalin wanted a communist world, but Jews are always singled out by every civilization, every society in which there is a demon man. That demon man is going to single out the Jews for greater suffering than any other people. The third lesson of the story of Purim is that all Jews have a common destiny. There's no such thing as any Jew thinking, I'm not going to be hurt. This does not affect me. Isn't that what Mordechai tells Esther? Don't think that because you are in the king's house, in the palace, you are going to be able to survive. Miodea, who knows? In late kazot, if next year you're even going to be a queen, you can have the same end as the Vashti. In hacharesh tacharishi late hazot, if you're going to remain silent, from another place there will be salvation. There's a common destiny. Let nobody think that, well, you know, there are two kinds of Jews. Those Jews are going to suffer, but we're not going to suffer. The settlers, they're obstacles to peace. That's the enemy. They're going to get it. Stunt Tel Aviv, nothing is going to happen. Everything is going to be fine. Or the Jew who may have thought that, those Jews with the beards and the curls, the payas, they're the ones. Our Jews who've been part of the German society, nothing is going to happen to them. Jews, part of the Communist Party, hand in hand with Lenin and Trotsky, they built the communism. So you think you're going to get away with it? There's no such thing. There's a common destiny. All Jews are united in the eyes of the aggressor. Yesh no am echo, there's one people, mefuzer u'mefored ben amin, they're spread out all over, and as far as I'm concerned, all of them don't follow the laws of the king. They should all be destroyed. The Rav ends with the final lesson of Purim is that he considers this the most important lesson. I'm certainly not going to do this any justice, because it will take another half an hour to an hour to do it justice. Basically, he says that there is a Shaliach Hashem. There is somebody whom God sends to bring the Yeshua, to bring salvation. You have to believe that somehow, somewhere, at some moment, there's going to be a salvation. Times may be difficult. In the process of Geula, the redemption of the Jewish people, someone will emerge as a leader, and that's the whole idea of Aninam and Bidias HaMashiach. But even before Mashiach, there is what's called the Shliach Hashem. Moshe was such a Shliach. Mordechai and Esther was such Shluchim. There's going to be a Shliach Hashem. What we have to pray for, and we have 3 days in Yerushalayim to pray for it, that we should have the Shliach Hashem who is going to end this nightmare for us. My best wishes to everybody for Chag Purim Sameach.